This morning I had a dream that I was in my grandparents' house, although it really wasn't their row home in South Philly or anything. It was some other kind of house, and it had been closed up, and I took what was like the cover off the windows, and it transformed the room, and I could see out the window, and I thought, wow, that just changes everything.
That just changes everything. I love it.
I thought this place, I never thought this place could look this nice with just an open window.
Wow. So that was a metaphor for your own consciousness,
I
right?
guess, yeah. Hopefully.
Who
Yeah.
would know?
Who would know? Although there in the view of the window there is a big mountain, and there's definitely no mountains in South Philly, just row homes.
First, there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. It's just a Donovan. It was an ode to Donovan that there was a mountain in the window. Your consciousness is very tricky. One thinks. One thinks one is the culmination of momentum of all that came before. And we're completely annoyed with ourselves and all that came before. So we get discouraged, right? That something like enlightenment, will never, should never happen to the likes of me, because I'm the product of so much thinking and so much conditioning that I just can't see my way clear. And this is all nonsense. But that conviction is so strong that one's present experience is must be the consequence of everything that came before. And we know from firsthand experience just how cluttered and, perhaps disappointed we are in our own consciousness or conscious experience. So, especially when those fuckers talk up, the Buddha or Adyashanti or whomever, right, as being of a special nature, right? The accomplishers of spiritual revelation by virtue of magical things that happened to them on the cushion or in their lives. And so they create this myth of a specialness that if you haven't had a curious spiritual experience, then, all bets are off. Forget it. The best you can do is hang out in the, what do they call them, the nosebleed seats, right, at the very top of the stadium, and simply watch everyone else enjoying their enlightened existence.
Yeah.
And
And maybe in the next life you'll get there.
then you've got the whole next life thing and all that other
Yeah.
stuff. And then these fuckers capitalize on the self-deprecating sorrow that all the seekers suffer from by then giving you a program, 3 pillars, 5 pillars, 10 steps, 6 steps. Right, it's a 4-month program, it's a 6-month program, it's a 3-year mystery school program, right? And then so then like parasites, they capitalize on one's indulgent disappointment in hopes that by going through this program, I too will get my fair share of spiritual experiences. Then in a brief 4-month period, work through all of my emotional issues that are entangling me. And then once I'm free as a bird and unafflicted, then I will be taught the, what's that French word for the, you know, the end of the meal or whatever it is? There's a word. Then I'll be taught
Bon
that.
Petit mort.
Sure. I'll be, you know,
I think that's
Mata
post
del
something
Toro.
Else. I think that's post
yeah,
something
exactly.
else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Postcoital depression, I think, is referred to. Then the teacher, after showing me enlightenment firsthand, working through my emotional material, decades worth of emotional material in a mere 2 months, then I will be taught how to integrate all this and live confidently in my new enlightenment sheath, so that I will be able to express, like all saints have expressed, wisdom and patience and compassion, perhaps healing, you know, magical powers, right? Like Joseph Goldstein has. That's the come on.
Well, when you put it like that, it sounds kind of silly.
Okay. Okay. Well, that might be, you know, a discerning observation to see what's implied by the language and the geometry of paying for a program that more or less guarantees you emancipation in a brief 4 months simply by watching, you know, Adyashanti blab at you impersonally, right, from his comfortable video pulpit. So, you see, awakening, if there is such a thing, and I hope there's not, actually, is nothing other than, you know, what's mysteriously coursing through your one's my consciousness this very moment. You see, it's nothing other than this. That's, you know, whether someone could say that with confidence may or may not be all that necessary, but at least to entertain it, right? To entertain that, oh, what was discovered by, you know, all the pundits or the accomplishers in the past or in the present was just this. And so what might happen is that one's, call it mind, or curious capacity for attentivity, reconsiders, right? It's a reconsideration of your present experience. Isn't it? Just that. Mm-hmm. It's just a reconsideration of one's present experience, which is so hard to come by because we're all so stupid or easily duped to think that we've nailed it, that by this time in our lives, or maybe by the time we're 2 years old even, right, we understand what consciousness is. We know what's going on. Our senses are functioning. We're content, right? I can go warm up a Pop-Tart in the toaster and slam down a glass of milk and go watch cartoons. Like, no problem. I got this. You know? And later on, I know how to, you know, groom and present myself in a way that maybe, you know, girls will like me. Or guys, depending on our, right, the way we're wired. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on from there. So we're delighted with the confidence that we have for functioning in the so-called world that has been, you know, expressed to us. We love it. We love being confident and adorable in whatever ways we do that. Maybe it's on the golf course, maybe it's behind a judge's, podium, right? Who knows? But we all love being competent, confident, expressive, and adorable. And so we think we've got this nailed down, and no one or nothing is going to tell us anything new about the nature of our present experience. Then if we become a seeker, we're really screwed, because we want something more than our present experience, but we're still suffering from the unnoticed hubris that we think we know what it is. So our seeking then becomes, we want magical demonstration, right? I mean, Krishnamurti had magical demonstrations, so I'll go talk to him and see what might be in store for my life. And the moment we want magical demonstration, that can only occur because we fail to see that our present consciousness is more magical than we can even tolerate, we can even bear. And so we go in search of dumbed down or cathartically demonstrative magical experience, like through, ayahuasca or salvia. Call it what you will.
So is it better not to have been a seeker at all?
No, nothing's better or worse, because, no one is handing you a scorecard.
Well, right? That's true.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think how to word it so it doesn't have a better or worse kind of
right
framing. There are certain people out there who are sort of not, super curious. They get up, they go to work, they come home.
Yes.
They go to the bar, they watch 3 hours of TV.
God, I love them.
And if you'd ask some question about, whatever, they'd be like, what does it matter,
Yeah, they could very well be quite happy with the rhythm and routine of their lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if they are despairing, it's probably been secreted away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
From themselves, even.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, secreted away. Yeah. Now, once you enroll someone in a course, what you've done is enrolled the person, right? You've enrolled the person in an aspiring meme or matrix, right? Because, I'm signing up for a course. I'm going to get insights into enlightenment. I'm going to be, perhaps given enlightenment on a silver tray. And then I'll learn how to, work through my all of the emotional clutter that I haven't been able to put a dent in for all these 50 years. Right? Mm-hmm. And then, people will be nicer to me and I will be nicer to them, and maybe I'll find true love, or I'll get a better job, a parking spot, right? Those hair plugs that I've been longing for all these years.
I'll either be at peace with getting the hair plugs, or my hair will grow.
Yeah, you see what happens? One takes the presumption of specialness or separateness into the future so that there's some confidence that I will feel better about myself or my experience in the future, right? As a consequence of being given the gift of enlightenment from the likes of Stephen Gray, Adya Shanti. Right, and so all of the whole bundle is based on a heretical and inconvenient presumption that I am human, conscious, and that I know all about this being human and being conscious, and I'm tired of suffering and insufficiency, self-doubt, right, self-torture, and for $350. I am out of here.
Well, it can be really disorienting to stop seeking, I think.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, let's say one need never stop seeking. But let's use the word interest, fascination, right? In lieu of seeking. It's the same thing, really. So fascination is, say, a present orientation. Whereas seeking, right, has a more gross connotation of places I've been and persons I've met, notes I've taken and experiences I've had. Right. So, but even seeking, which rolls out, carpet rolls out in the circumstances and events of our life, what we're really doing is taking our fascination on the road. Right?
Mm.
Yeah. So if I join a mystery school, it's because I'm absolutely fascinated with myself, with my firsthand experience. I see that I'm dissatisfied with myself and my firsthand experience, but I'm still fascinated by myself, and so I'm going to take myself on the road and participate in a 2-year-long mystery school so I can benefit from improved experience. But what's driving it? Well, fascination. I love myself. I love my experience. And it's just, I'm not meeting my own standards. Right? I'm suffering because I'm not meeting my own standards of care, of affection, of magical interlude, of at-one-ment. Right? Shit like that. You know, when I sing Kumbaya, it's just me, right? And I want to hold hands with the whole universe and sing Kumbaya. You see, and so all of these things are, they're deflective, right? They create the imagination of time, of space, and me in time space as a, you know, human.
Yes.
And right.
Reflective and deferring.
Yes, you see, all of that is ultimately deflective and deferring because I'm taking the likes of me on the road in search of mo better experience. It's like, you know, Jack Kerouac. Mm. Let's just jump in the car and go. And therefore we fail to have a relationship with our fascination, which is autonomous and present. Because I'm taking my body, right? I'm taking my body on the road, my personality on the road, my craving for a better experience. I'm taking it on the road. And even if I sit in a meditation cushion, without, you could say, the proper instruction or the proper orientation for seated meditation, I'm still taking myself on the road, though I haven't gone anywhere, right, physically. I mean, go yeah. hang out on a 3-month Vipassana retreat, right? Everyone's taking themselves on the road.
There's a goal.
Yeah, there's something going on, right? And it's all, well, it's punctuated by, you know, their best effort at the Pali instruction set for piercing the veil of the, you know, the three characteristics, right? Dukkha, anicca, and anatta. So the meditation is designed, the Vipassana meditation is designed to dismantle the most subtle of myths. But guess what? It doesn't work.
They sure have good press then, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it would be fun to go to, you know, IMS just after the close of the three-month meditation retreat and interview everyone that sat the retreat.
I think there's a half-life to those retreats, but I know that's deflective and deferring, too.
Well, sure.
Sure.
Sure it is. You see, because even if there's some perfume that lingers, right, after a long period of contemplation or artificial sensory deprivation, which is what a retreat is, right? It's kind of artificial sensory deprivation to focus energy or focus attention on the playing monkey see, monkey do with the Buddha. You know? Well, Jesus, if he sat under a tree one night, I mean, can I nail this shit in 3 months? Plus interviews with Joseph? I mean, he may have been the Buddha, but I'm me, and I get to talk with Joseph once or twice a week while sitting on my can for 3 months. I should be able to nail this. But guess what?
Nailed it.
Doesn't work.
Doesn't work.
No. I mean, it doesn't mean it's not wonderful, right? Or that one should discard that experience or not participate in it.
Well, that's those paradoxical things that are, like, frustrating,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, the fun part is to reconsider whether you or one is a dissatisfied or unsatisfactory human to begin with.
Once you're a human, dissatisfaction just goes with the territory.
Yes. Once the presumptuous mechanism of recording and reporting on experience kicks into gear, right? Which is just ephemeral. And if we associate ourselves with that ephemera, then samsara has won out. And this is a subtle point of inflection, because we're not now focused on circumstances and events, right? Those aren't so important. We withdraw, you could say, our loyalty from circumstances and events, being the barometer for my, right, spiritual life. And so I learn to look right here. And maybe there's a lifting of, call it a veil, or the inertia, the burdensome inertia of memory, of identity, of relying upon circumstances and events in my future to be the telltale deliverable, right, of my enlightenment. Because everyone that signs up for Adyashanti's program, and not to belabor, you know, his idolatry, but all of the programs, all of the idolatry, is we're taking ourselves on the road, thinking that enlightenment is an objective of a person. And it's not. Whatever this is turns out to be whatever this is. Just here. Just now. You're the gift and the magic of your present attention is not the consequence of anything that you've thought prior to this moment. Right? The presence of you is not the consequence of anything that has happened prior to this moment. The magical nature of your attention is not the consequence of anything. And so you are, one is absolutely unconditioned. As in, hello, right here, right now, completely unconditioned. But this, you know, little morsel of magic, we don't give any attention to. Instead, we put on our seatbelt and signed up for the, you know, the Wednesday evening video conference so that we can gain knowledge from somebody else. How can you gain knowledge from somebody else?
Mm.
There is nobody else. There's only your present autonomy. That's all there is for you, for me, for anyone. Yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So where can I go? To whom can I go to be myself? It's kind of silly. And then if some talking head, you know, intrudes upon my consciousness voluntarily or otherwise, then, you know, what happens? I start aligning my consciousness with the words that are being spoken by somebody else? About what? About enlightenment, as if enlightenment is a thing that they own, earned, accomplished? Not happening. I mean, like any word, enlightenment is an idea, right?
Mm.
Samsara is an idea. Your or one's self-consideration of your present experience is, it's an idea. Right?
Mm.
If you or I self-accuse or report upon what's bothering me or not bothering me, what I'm excited about or what I'm refusing, it's an idea.
Yes, true.
Yeah. So if there's a methodology, and thankfully there's not, because there's nothing other than this to attain to for the likes of you, so how could there possibly be a methodology?
Well, I guess, I mean, increasing awareness that it's just an idea. I mean, those kinds of programs, I guess, enhance the ability to recognize that.
Yes.
Huh?
Yeah, there's, let's call it all these symptoms of the grand adventure of reconsidering. So yes, there can be an educational process, a temporal process. Can appear to be.
Appear to be.
Yeah, it appears to be, like everything else appears to be. Like, who won last year's Indy 500? I don't know.
Mario Andretti, right. I think. That's the only
Andre,
person I know.
Andre the Giant. Oh, was there a wrestling match? Andre the Giant won. No, he's deceased.
Oh, I know. I saw him in the airport once.
Did you?
Yeah, he was having a beer around 8 a.m. in the airport. Who could blame him?
Yeah, a book was written about him made a lot of fanfare about what a prodigious drinker he was.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, he was so huge that he could drink any creature alive under the table.
Oh my gosh, I bet.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a reconsideration of fascination. And that's where you can begin, one can begin to see just how restless and crazed and temporally bound my present experience is. Right? We can really look into the heart of suffering, not through circumstances and events, where it's easy to blame everyone and everything, but we look into the heart of delusion or confusion right here, right now, right? Because you are simply a disembodied fascination. And the question is, what's on your channel selector? Yeah. Right? You are, this is, one is disembodied fascination. Floating without locus or reference. Now, it may seem that, you are you inside you, as in your body, right? You are you inside you, as in your brain or your head or your mind, right? But it's not that difficult to see that those are also ideas. Free-floating fascination is not encased, ensconced, nor is it the consequence of anything. Pretty much that simple. Now, having a conversation that redirects our attention to how we are feeling presence. Is maybe helpful. It doesn't have to be, spontaneously, cathartically enlightening. It's like, so what? But that one can, let's say, learn or appreciate or feel their way into feeling themselves without referring to reference making. Could be fun. Learning to enjoy disembodied fascination on its terms rather than ignoring it completely and running around trying to get enlightened to dispel superficial myths. Let's say all of creation or creativity, phenomenal expression, is actually not about anything. I mean, how brief have so-called humans been around? And how few years might the species have remaining when one considers the warnings of the progressive climatologists? So what would the entire universe be about were, just for fun, humans as we've known and loved them, were to cease as a viable species? What would it be about then?
Yeah, we'd be out of luck.
Yeah. At SOL, right? Shit out of luck. Right. But the feeling tone of your present experience is not subject to relevancy of any kind. and getting a sense of it, that your present fascination as non-focused and non-clinging elasticity is not about anything. That could be, you know, challenging or threatening, or joyful. It's like we place a demand that joy, you know, quote, enlightenment, has to appear and appeal to us in a certain manner. And that's, so we're kind of hunting for an experience, or let's say the repeat or sustenance of an experience we once had, or that we hope to have, right? So you can feel the momentum of bringing you as a packet of fascination, corporeally identified, into a future where, you know, joy and peace and creativity are, you know, the standards of your experience, right? Yeah. And so we drag the idea of ourselves into an idealized future. And we hope that after we spend the 350 and have gone through the four-month program, that we can inhabit this idealized notion of ourselves. Thank you, Adya Shanti. For how many years do people hang out with the lovely Pamela Wilson and get a sense of her heartfelt, you know, therapeutic enlightenment?
Yeah, I've always wondered what it would be like to have all kinds of money and then you can go to as many of these things as your, you know, your heart desire, you know.
Some people do have that money and go to as many of those things as their heart desires. There was a wealthy guy in the Bay Area that was bankrolling Isaac Shapiro every time Isaac would come from South Africa or wherever to do like a month, more or less a month-long, right? Month-long dialogue program. The house would be, you know, maybe a couple hundred people or something at the beginning, and toward the end, everyone had petered out. You know, it was like 20 people left in the room. Because even if you're getting, God, even if you're getting a great experience by being in the company of a radiant arhant, right? Even if you're getting stoned, right? In the company of a so-called awakener, it's not going to do you.
Yeah.
It can become a dependency relationship, and it's probably one of the best kinds of dependency relationships available to humanity, right? I mean, if Ramana Maharshi were alive and some in Jenkintown, would you go?
Yes.
Yes. You know, but if he were in Ohio, right? Maybe you'd go for a weekend. Right? But you wouldn't discard your life to go hang out with Ramana. But who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah. But you see, even hanging out with, call it accomplishers, right? I mean, Adyashanti is an accomplisher. There's no question about it. It's not even necessary to, you know, call someone's enlightenment into question or not, really. Because it's all about you anyway. But even as an accomplisher, you know, one wonders, how was he able, if at all, to convey the magical experiences that occurred to him, right, or the revelation that occurred to him, to others? I mean, it's, you know, a lot of this game, the guru game, is people flock to the destination where someone is either pretending to have or actually having a high conversion rate. Why do you think everyone was going to Lucknow to go see Papaji? Because for a time it seemed like there was a spate of enlightenment pouring out of his ministry. Wayne Lickerman used to, you know, joke, probably still does, that all you had to do was fly over Lucknow and you'd get enlightened. But then even in Wayne's own lineage, you know, someone had written a book highlighting.
Sorry.
Sure. Bat phone?
Mom, wondering if I had gone out and got into a car accident, I'm sure.
Even someone had written a book about all of the people that had purportedly woken up in the care and company of Ramesh Balsekar.
Well, so
I mean, you don't hear much about them, you know, these days. Maybe they're just happily non-dual in the privacy of their lives.
So you think it just doesn't last, though? Your guess is that people get high for a while, but there's diminished returns and...
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, claims are made. You know, John Wheeler from Palo Alto or something went to see Sailor Bob, you know, and woke the fuck up and wrote a bunch of books. Some of them apparently were, you know, pretty good and insightful. And then was doing teachings and talks, right, down in that area, playing his guitar, you know, singing non-dual country songs, kind of like John Denver under the influence of salvia.
I think he liked Coke.
Yeah, I think he liked Coke, yeah. Well, it's better to fly experimental aircraft under the influence of Coke.
Yeah.
Can't beat the thrill.
If you were
and
driving,
John...
Yeah.
John Wheeler gave up, you know, teaching, whatever that means, to go hang out with, what's his name, in Sonoma. You know, the guy with the cool paintings, which
Alex
no one
Gray?
Has ever heard of. No. This, we went to go see him. It was a fun day. What was his name again? Shrinar, you know, he's an Indian guy. You know, he's an Indian guy, and he painted some beautiful paintings that are kind of mysterious shapes and colors and weird things go on when you look at them. And, you know, they'll, like, send you on a ride.
Mm.
And so, you know, John Wheeler gave up his, you know, the public accomplishment of his own enlightenment and dispensary, right? His enlightenment dispensary, to go hang out with, you know, so-and-so up in Sonoma so that they could spend all day talking about non-duality. I mean, at some point, you know, put some ham and eggs on the grill.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that, I'm just saying it's, you know, it's weird what happens to people, what kind of catharses they go through or what they experience in the company of the master and how many masters have they, you know, been with and sat with. I mean, even the folks at IMS, you know, started getting tired of the Vipassana model because of diminishing returns, right? And they started leaning toward the Dzogchen, right? But they were like, don't say anything.
Keep it on the down low.
Yeah, right? And you're like, why did all of these decades of incredible dedication to the Vipassana model of dismantling, right, and insight, run out of a certain kind of steam? And so people that were at it for a long time started adopting interest in other methodologies. How bizarre.
Well, I guess it's so one track, maybe, you know.
Well, it's fun to see just how mysteriously cathartic one's present identification with space, time, and self is. Because what nut are we cracking? Are we cracking a nut that occurred at our conception, at the time of the Big Bang? as the consequence of all of the momentum and experience that has occurred to us throughout our so-called lives? What nut is it that we're trying to crack? And wouldn't that nut, if there were one, simply be a luminous misidentification with one's presently appearing disembodied fascination? Right? Right here, right here. Like there is no place else to go. There's no place else to look. There's no point in ruminating about the past or the present or the future from the point of view of tackling head on, right, the genesis of, call it duality or non-duality. It's just this, you see?
Just this.
Yeah, and you are already made of stardust, fairy dust.
And scrapple.
You are all, and scrapple, of course, yeah. Scrapple, yeah. And who could go without? You are disembodied fascination. But no one, you know, said to you when you were young, God, I love you, Suzanne. You're like the best disembodied fascination ever. Right? So if you got any soothing or kudos, and we can appreciate few of us had any, it was about whether you were a good girl, right? A good person, a good body, right?
Yeah.
Your behavior was in line. You ate your food, right? You got an A on a test. You this, you that. So all of the reinforcement was all, right, task-oriented. It was all about behavior, that your behavior was laudable. And so we're like, oh, I'm a good boy. Oh, I'm a good girl. Oh, I got an A on a test. Oh, mommy, look at this. Oh, I flushed the toilet. Yes. You know, I pooed all by myself. Right? And so all of the reinforcement that happens to an otherwise magical disembodied fascination, you could say becomes corporeal and time-bound. And behavior triggered or behavior locked, right? So we take this total mistake on the road to get enlightened because, God, we've really had it with ourselves. And the long string of failures that we've suffered from or are suffering from. But it won't work. Adyashanti's course won't work. You know, I'm sure I'm wrong. You know, maybe some fucker that takes the course just out of, you know, chill thrill turns out to like, whoa, holy shit, right? But it won't be because of the course, right?
Yeah.
It'll just be the serendipity of that, you could say, that soul's nut to crack.
Yeah.
But practically speaking, without getting all Swami-esque about the whole thing, at present, whatever that is, and we really don't know what it is, there is this irrefutability. What's dreamed about the irrefutability is legend. Profound. What's dreamed about it is legend, is profound. But what would happen if we turned this irrefutability, this disembodied fascination, you could say in on itself, without occupying one's experience as a person, as a body, as a behavior system, as space, as time, as all of these, you know, inconvenient superimpositions. I think that's a decent question.
Stop filtering it, translating it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Because if you're trying to enlighten the product of the filtering and the translating, it won't work. if there's enlightenment, one might suggest that it's the abatement or abeyance of any identification with the filtering. It's not, doesn't mean that the filtering has to stop, right? It doesn't mean that mind has to cease as a body of symptom. It's subtler than that. It's that there's no association with the apparitional nature of dreaming appearing to you as disembodied fascination.
There's no identification with the filtering, I guess.
There's none. Well, there's no identification with nothing,
With
not the filtering,
nothing.
not the apparent apparitional consequence of the filtering, right? And not even with what we're referring to as disembodied fascination. Because there's no identity is possible, you could say, with disembodied fascination. Because it is itself.
True.
Mean,
And they're, yeah.
that's what's, hinted at when one you might use the term non-dual, right?
Non-dual or no thing. Is it?
Yeah, well,
Yeah.
there's no non-dual is that this is this, and you're not experiencing it through an apparatus which is other than it, right? Yeah, when I say my experience, my mood, my day, my this, my that, right? All of that is commentary which is emanating from you as the experiencer, right? As the body, as the temporally and spatially bound recipient of consciousness. That's dual. Non-dual would suggest if there is an opposite of that, which is, oh, here is this fascination and an endless stream, right, of apparitional elements, right? I mean, whoa. Even in a quiet moment, right, one can feel an endless stream of apparitional elements appearing in your subtle consciousness, if we want to call it, conscious, subconscious, unconscious. No matter where you look, there's going to be an absolutely endless stream of apparitional nuance that's just radiating right out or in or of its own nature
Yeah.
to you as disembodied attentivity, fascination. And there's no difference, right, between the presence and recognition of fascination and the apparitional elements that appear in it. Okay? So there's so right. So if you boil off all the wine, you've got the perfect reduction sauce. It appears you've got two things. You've got apparitional elements, nuanced beyond speech, right? And the fascination that feels itself being on the receiving end, right, of nuanced apparition. Yes? So that's, you could say, the most naked duality that one could get to, quote, or articulate. Fascination, apparitional elements. Still two, right?
Still two.
Remarkably subtle. I mean, perhaps delightful, blissful, God knows, but still, right? So then, whatever that feels like, cancel on the duality. Right? 86 on the duality. So now there's absolutely no, call it separation or causal chain of these two articulated, call them subtle frames of reference, namely the attentivity, which is just expressive fascination, and all of the apparitional elements appearing in or to the expressive fascination is only how many? Itself. It's only itself. It's nutty, right? And but without accusing you of anything, dare I say that's your present experience. Yeah. I mean, underneath all the symptoms of I and self, emotion and, you know, disappointment and all that. I mean, forget about all that, because we can appreciate that everything that's appearing in you as you, including identity, is just a flow of apparitional elements, apparitional nuance. Without assigning it any meaning or creating a story, then it's just apparitional nuance. And apparitional nuance is appearing to whom? To what? Well, in a way, it's appearing to itself, but we're referring to that, the subject, as disembodied fascination. Now there's no two. Apparitional nuance appears to disembodied fascination as a singularity. It's not two. That's, if there's a takeaway from Adyashanti's 4-month program, if it's not that, don't pay. Because if I or one or he overwhelms you, right, with stuff, it's just stuff. It's the dissatisfying disappointment of apparitional nuance.
Well, I guess it's
assigned meaning.
It's catering to mind, which is like this binge eater of whatever.
Yeah, that's right. That program is for binge eaters, spiritual binge eaters.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, you know, I'm glad he's making a living and he's taking good care of Mukti, and or she's making a living, and you know, he has an empire of enlightenment going on, a mini empire of enlightenment. And so does Bentinho, and so does, you know, Wayne Dyer, and God knows who else, right?
Yeah.
These are empires. These kinds of, you know, awakeners build empires. Thich Nhat Hanh, right? Big empire.
Yeah.
In the name of what? Whatever the Buddha discovered by sitting under a tree? Why would you build an empire over what happened to a guy sitting under a tree? See, it gets a little strange.
It does get strange, yeah.
It does get strange, but you know, humans are, right, what we're tribal, right? We're pack creatures. And so when a big idea comes through, you know, we huddle. And so Thich Nhat Hanh's order of interbeing, you know, is a giant organism huddled around what exactly? Not that Jesus rose. No, you know, it's huddled around, oh, Buddha defeated Mara. Look, hey, that's fantastic. Let's huddle. Let's eat slowly. We'll eat slowly. We'll touch our beautiful eyes. We'll go on retreats. You know, we'll get brown jackets. We'll become holders of the lamp. We'll read Thich Nhat Hanh's books and videos. Right? We'll huddle.
Yeah, like how many Joe Schmoes have probably had the same sort of conflict, I guess, right? The same sort of journey and, I don't know.
It's very simple.
Yeah.
Fascination, to which is appearing apparitional nuance. Not to. What would it look like or feel like to take residence in that observation? And give full permission, not that anyone asked you for it, for the life to live itself, which is what it's done anyway. Right? The life has lived itself. You've had absolutely nothing to do with it, but be either a complainer, an enjoyer, or a reporter. And all of those roles are fantasy. The life lives itself. You happen to be of the nature, non-dual nature, of disembodied fascination, enjoying nuanced apparition nonstop. That's what's happening. But once we interject ourselves into this beatitude as the person, as the corporeally mandated creature with self-will and choice-making, then we just miss the beauty of it all. Or our consciousness has become encrusted so that we've become desensitized. And, I trust that Adyashanti will do his best to re-sensitize all of his students to speechless autonomy. But I don't know if it takes 4 months. It pretty much only takes about a minute or two. And then repeat. And if you're going to repeat...
Ad infinitum.
Yeah, and if you're going to repeat, well, at least have fun repeating, right? Come up with a few new, ways of toying with the nature of a non-dual infinitude. And it's not that difficult to do because a non-dual infinitude has no bottom with respect to, self-reflecting metaphor. That's why it's so curiously fun. You can say the same thing or speak about the same thing over and over and over and over and over again, but it's like, it's wild every time.
Mm.
Because this is, because you are. You are wild in every moment. And so this can get away with what appears to be repetition in a thrilling or satisfying way. At least I play with it that way. I don't want to force it on anyone else.